And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. Annie here. G'day, Matthew. How are you?
Good. It's great to be in the studio this morning, Annie.
Yeah, it is. And it's not even as cold as it has been. That's the weather report. It's becoming sunny. We've got a bit of rain, but sun as well.
Yeah, and I noticed on the way, and it was 10 degrees.
I know, that's wild.
I think last weekend it was, what, 4?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't have to be rugging up quite as much as previous. But if you are, you can just lie back and listen and snuggle under the doona on Solidarity Breakfast 3CR, your community radio station. And I have to do a belated thank you very much for the people who contributed to the radiothon for Solidarity Breakfast in particular. We literally are $20 under our full target. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that. But yeah, again, a very heartfelt thank you to everyone who has supported Solidarity Breakfast and also 3CR as a whole.
And there's two particular mentions. One was a $600 donation by an anonymous person in queue. So thank you very much. This is not to take away from any of the much smaller donations, but it really does warm the cockles of one's heart to get such a profound amount of donation. And the other is to a wonderful person from East Ballarat who is an ongoing contributor. She puts $20 in a month, which is builds up, which is a lovely contribution and keeps the station and the program going. So thank you very much indeed. Anyway, moving on, we've got some headlines. You've got something in particular to start off with?
Yeah, I came across, read this last night, and this is out of the New Arab, an update on Donald Trump's Orwellian-sounding Board of Peace for Gaza. They've actually secured their first construction contract to build a military outpost for 150 Moroccan troops that will be stationed inside the Palestinian territory. According to a source familiar with the plans who spoke to The Guardian, the yet-to-be-finalised contract was awarded to Arkel International. This is a firm based in Louisiana that previously carried out work for the US government in countries including Iraq. So, yes, that's they were involved in the occupation of Iraq.
Yeah, this is at the same time as we heard at the rally last week that from Olive Kids founder that...
That's Amin Abbas,
yeah.
Who's on the board of Olive Kids.
He was talking about the fact that there's a whole lot of aid, stuff of that nature, stranded, unable to get in through the borders. This is a deliberate genocidal behaviour coming from the US supporting their mates in Israel. This is at the same time as the first burials of family remains.
Yeah, there was a report on Monday that two families, I'm sorry, I don't have the names of the families, but it was 112. That's the largest mass burial. And I did see some...
They were removed from the rubble.
They were removed from
dedication.
The rubble.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing to note is that if we were to read out all of the names of the children that were being killed, it would take 54 years.
Yeah. Shame job. Complete shame job.
Yeah.
If we don't leave the US just for a second... The US Senate Committee, I mean, the Orwellian nature of what's going on in the US at the top echelons is sort of breathtaking. The the World Socialist website is reporting that the Senate committee is holding Fauci, the chief medical officer during COVID, in contempt as multiple outbreaks rage across the US. It's fascinating what they're doing is, and this is what the report's saying, the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee voted along party lines Thursday to hold Anthony Fauci in contempt of Congress. Fascistic committee chairman Rand Paul announced that his office would hand deliver the referral to the Justice Department that same afternoon, bypassing a vote of the full Senate. The referral of the country's most prominent public health official for criminal prosecution is not an inquiry into the origins of COVID-19, but an effort to establish the precedent that any scientific advice which constrains profit is a criminal act. Bizarro.
It's really bizarre. And also, if we consider that one of Trump's chief appointments was to Robert Kennedy Jr., who's been a long miscreant, who's discredited science and suggested things such as that vaccines are a contributor to autism in children. And I note that I also, on that theme of infection, there are mass outbreaks of measles that are taking place in the United States. Yeah, that's pretty disturbing.
It's very disturbing.
Yeah.
And on another side, this is another element in the falling apart of the structures that protect the American people. And, I mean, we talk about this because what happens in America sends reverberations around the world. It really makes you wonder about globalization. Is it a good thing? Question mark, question mark, question mark. Donald Trump has nominated four candidates for the US Postal Service Board of Governors in an attempted takeover of the cherished public institution, which is older than the nation itself, says Intercept. And he knows that USPS is responsible for carrying millions of ballots during the midterm elections. So it just rolls on.
It rolls on. In fact, I've got a long memory. That's a theme in American politics when there's been contested elections. Even going so back far as the election that brought in Bush Jr. So, and there were similar things there had to check through individual ballots. And the problem with the American system, unlike ours, is they don't have a universal body that oversees.
They don't have an electoral commission.
Exactly. So that's the problem. And also they can have different forms of voting depending on what state or even city that they're in. And I think that...
Slippery fish.
Yeah, so I think that issue then lends to potential manipulation.
Now, the other, if we come closer to home, it was reported there's going to be an election in Victoria later in the year. I think it's in October. Free Palestine, there's a party that's been put itself up and is now going to be on the ballot, and it's called Free Palestine Party. It's actually a fake. It's a fake group of right-wing provocateurs aiming to dupe Victorian electors. And basically, you need to be aware that you shouldn't be fooled by this disgusting, cynical approach, which exposes the true nature of right-wing parties, right-wing influences, effectively. They think it's really funny. And so they got away with it. And as a result, the genuine party that wishes to espouse these views has been stymied from using a name that will explicitly show what they stand for. So to say it again, Free Palestine Party, that's what it calls itself, Free Palestine Party is a fake. It's a fake party.
And I have an update on that. This is just 12 minutes ago. I published on the ABC website and I quote, I've just got a quote here, from student Palestinian activist Ibrahim Hadi, who was he tried to register a counterparty and it was actually rejected. But what he did say, the Free Palestine Party is trying to paint themselves as Palestinian and use the Palestinian identity to poke fun at people that are standing up for the oppressed.
Yeah, it's really quite disgusting.
It is quite disgusting. And to note, this free so-called Free Palestine Party was registered by Avi Yemeni, who many of you may have aware of. He's affiliated with so-called Rebel News. And he's previously served in Israel's military. And
And he thinks it's hilarious.
Yeah, he thinks it's hilarious. He's a provocateur. He gets on social media and YouTube and, intimidates. Uses methods that, kind of.
Actually, it underpins an ongoing stream of views that comes out of Zionist Australia, which is that Australians in general are stupid. And they are the smartest people in the room.
Yeah, and he's actually just got this is on the ABC website now. Mr. Yemeni has previously said by registering Free Palestine, he wanted to redirect left-wing votes towards parties on the right.
We'll move on to the report that has just come out off the books, Practical Guidance for Business Direct. It's come out of... University of New South Wales. It's a new research which found that two-thirds of temporary migrant workers across Australia are underpaid, with one in four losing at least $10 an hour. The research found two-thirds of temporary migrant workers across Australia were underpaid, shortchanged by at least $10 an hour. It also shows that the more severe the underpayment, the more likely the workers are to experience indicators of forced labour, such as coercion, intimidation and restricted freedom. But, of course, the people in federal politics like to say that there's no slavery in Australia. Last month, the Australian federal government announced its intention to introduce a new criminal, in inverted commas, failure to prevent modern slavery offence, targeting large companies with annual consolidated revenues over $100 million. The guidance shows Australian companies where forced labour risks occur in practice, including misuse of ABNs, insecure casual employment, misleading payslips, cash payments and underpaid night or weekend work. It also emphasises the need to safely engage workers, noting many temporary visa holders fear retaliation or visa consequences if they speak up. And it might be added that the CFMEU, the attacks on the CFMEU and the administration, that will actually hamper this actual supposed work by the federal government, because it's on the ground in the construction industry. It's an ongoing issue, this kind of mistreatment of refugees and people who are from other ethnic groups.
And I think this report illustrates the reason why the Migrant Worker Centre, which is housed in the Trades Hall, it was established several years ago. And the very important work that it does, and other allied organisations like the Human Rights Law Centre as well.
Exactly. They've been doing a lot of work. More reports will come out of 3CR following some of their work. The Physical Disability Australia has told a Senate hearing that NDIS reform cannot be built on the false premise that people with disability are a burden to be reduced, and has recommended an alternative approach that significantly reduces the NDIS debt without impacting support. Susan Gearing, who's the CEO of the Physical Disability Australia, said a narrative has crept into public debate that frames people with disability as an expense to be reduced. That narrative is not only harmful, it is false, and it is leading us toward reform options that reform that word, options that would cut the very supports that allow people with disability to live, work and contribute. She confirmed the organisation rejected any reform pathway that reduces supports for participants in order to fix a scheme shaped by design flaws, administrative inefficiency and poor stewardship. The NDIS is under real financial pressure, but cutting eligibility or slashing packages would only shift costs elsewhere into unemployment, poorer health, poverty and crisis care. Stripping support is not reform. It is a failure disguised as restraint, she said.
My thoughts are just towards those who are in the NDIS and receiving support, and I guess the uncertainty that they must feel with all this attention and that the NDIS has been a target.
Yeah, exactly. And just on a happy note, the climate defenders who represented 117 of the arrestees from Rising Tide, the 2024 People's Blockade protests, the New South Wales police have dropped the remaining charges arising from Rising Tide 2024 People's Blockade, where hundreds of people entered the water of Newcastle Harbour, the site of the world's largest coal port, to protest coal exports, and it contributed and its contribution to climate change. Police withdrew anti-protest charges after they failed to prosecute test cases and were required to pay $73,000 in cost. Boom, boom.
That is a great result. I'm just looking quickly here at Rising Tide's website, and they said that the 125 people faced two charges under the Crimes and Marine Safety Acts, including the anti-protest laws, for which a maximum penalty of $22,000 fine or 2 years in prison. And of course, we did speak a couple of weeks ago, something similar happened with those were facing charges in Sydney with the protest, the President Herzog protests, and that those, the laws that were targeting those protesters were found to be not valid. So hopefully those charges will be dropped when they process through the courts.
Yeah, all good stuff.
Are you ready to get lost in science this National Science Week? We'll join the Lost in Science team for our annual Trivia Night extravaganza at the Birmingham Hotel. A hop, skip and a jump away from 3CR on the corner of Smith and Johnson Streets in Fitzroy. Presented by the Lost in Science team with new and old science questions across a range of topics. Picture rounds, group activities and prizes big and small to be won by you and your team. At the Burmy, corner of Smith and Johnson Streets, Fitzroy. That date again, Monday, 17th of August. To get your tickets, you can look up Lost in Science Trivia 2026 online or head to 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au. Get lost in science during National Science Week.
And you're back with Solidarity Breakfast with Annie and Matt and Tobias.
Tobias,
how are you?
How are you?
It's not even cold, man. It's not even cold.
Excuse me. Riding down from the mighty reservoir on the bush bike.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah. Well, better than any of us. Okay, so we'll forgive you. We're going to move on to a speech that was made at the last Palestine rally here in Melbourne on last Sunday, and it's a voice of a person who's just come back from the West Bank.
Yeah, I think in Mustafa Yafa, in the village there. Yep.
Our last speaker, a young lady went to the West Bank, particularly to Msafir Yatta, to support our community there who subjected to the violence of the terrorist settlers. She spent 6 months there with them, supporting them and advocate for peace. Please welcome Sahar to the stage.
I'm a little nervous and my chest is tight and I've got a cry sitting like right here, so bear with me. Bear with me as I try to get through this. Before I begin, I want to acknowledge that, as mentioned, it wasn't mentioned, but I was born in colonized Palestine, or so-called Israel, And like most Jewish Israelis, I grew up immersed in Zionism and was not spared the indoctrination that led me to serve in the terrorist organization that is the IOF. Something I carry with deep shame every day. I don't share that because this speech today is about me, but because I believe you deserve to know who is standing in front of you, because accountability begins with honesty. But today is not my story to tell. I'm standing here today to amplify the voices of the people of a small village called Umm al-Khair in the area called Masafer Yatta in the West Bank, a community whose story reflects a much broader reality across Palestine. You might have heard of these places and you might have heard his name. The story of his murder was shared around the world, but who he really was wasn't. And unfortunately, his story being shared hasn't helped the community escape the cruel reality they have continued to endure ever since. I wasn't fortunate enough to have met Audeh Hadalin, alayhi rahmo, but for the last 6 months, his family has become my family, and through them, I've had the privilege of getting a glimpse of who he was. Not just through photos, videos, and endless stories, but also through the way his legacy, his memory, his presence, his work, and his vision are cherished and continue to live on through his family, his community, and every person who was fortunate enough to fight alongside him. Pain paralyzes me when I think of my dear Hanadi, Alda's beloved wife, who at 25 lost the love of her life, her best friend, and their father to their three beautiful and cheeky boys. Watan, their eldest, is 6 years old. He's one of the most emotionally intelligent kids I know. When Hanadi cries, he goes to wipe the tears from her eyes. Muhammad Alde, also known as Hamoudi, is now 4 years old, but was just 3 years old when he was in the loving arms of his father when he was shot. And little Kanan, just a year and a half old, looks the most like his father, but is too young to have formed any memories of him. On the 28th of July, 2025, Ode was inside Umm al-Khir's community center doing what he so often did, documenting what was happening to his community. As settlers invaded the village to begin the establishment of a new illegal outpost in the heart of the village, internationally sanctioned settler Inon Levy drew his gun and fired. One of those bullets took Ode's life. Ode filmed his own death. What happened after his murder tells us something about the system that allowed it to happen in the first place. His killer went around the village alongside the occupation forces, pointing out people to be arrested. More than 20 men, Alde's brothers, cousins, and friends, were detained for more than a week, were humiliated and tortured. His body was withheld for 10 days. Inon Levy spent only one night in custody and remains free till this day. Just days after Alde's murder, he returned to the village and continued the construction of the outpost. This past Tuesday, while Alde's loved ones were commemorating his life and mourning his death, Zionist forces invaded the village during his memorial. Alde's murder and the reality of Umm al-Khir are not isolated incidents. They are the product of a systematic Zionist structure that backs, protects, and grants impunity to settler terrorists, encouraging attacks against Palestinian communities to continue with no accountability as part of the ongoing ethnic cleansing and dispossession of Palestinians in pursuit of the Zionist project. Over the last 6 months, I have witnessed this system from up close. I have watched Salem, Alde's oldest brother, being taken away in an ambulance after settler terrorists carried out a pogrom in his backyard, the same land where the outpost established by Inon Levy has been built, as they once again got away with stealing more land and further choking the village. I have watched Iz, Alde's 19-year-old nephew, being arrested by the IOF for simply filming settlers as they trespassed into the village to put an Israeli flags up on Palestinian homes. I have watched Khaled, Alde's 3-year-old nephew, so small that his head was barely an inch below the rifle of the soldier standing in front of him, while that soldier protected settlers as they attacked the village. I stood among men, women, children, elders, and activists as we were pushed into a sheep pen like animals by the apartheid forces while allowing the settlers to continue committing more crimes in Salem's backyard. I've watched the cuts forming on my friend's hands as they hung on to the barbed wire being moved by settlers to determine new borders between the village and the outpost. I've watched the courageous children of Umm al-Khir protest at the fence that settlers put up on the road on the way to school, a fence designed to deprive them of their right to education. These are just a few of my experiences in Umm al-Khir. In the whole of my Safariyata area, in the past 6 months, I have witnessed the establishment of 4 illegal outposts, the theft of livestock and harvests, the arson of cars and homes, violent illegal arrests, land theft, home demolitions, live ammunition, stone throwing, invasions, the killing of livestock, the destruction of essential infrastructure, the daily humiliation, harassment, and terrorization of Palestinian communities. And this is only accelerating by the day. Imagine the resilience it takes to survive this every day for a lifetime. This is the story of just one village in the West Bank, but in Palestine, everyone has an order in their life. Since October 7th, 62 Palestinian communities have been forcibly displaced across the West Bank, and more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed. Every one of these people was a whole universe. I'd like to read a piece by Tarek Adalin, Alda's cousin and close friend. 1 year, 365 days, yet I still cannot convince my heart that you are gone. I've written about demolished homes. I've written about children crying in the middle of the night. I've written about soldiers, settlers, checkpoints, roadblocks, dying sheep, uprooted trees, and villages slowly disappearing from the map. But today I cannot write, because this is not another story. This is you, my brother, my friend, Alde. People ask me if time heals. It doesn't. It only teaches you how to carry a wound that never closes. For an entire year, I've searched for you in a very familiar place. In every dusty road of Umm al-Khir, in every cup of tea shed with friends, in every sunset over our hills. Sometimes I still catch myself thinking, I have to call Ali. Then reality strikes me again, and I die one more time. The world knew your name. They knew the activist, the defender, the man who stood between his community and justice with nothing but courage and truth. I knew the man, the human being behind all of that, the man whose laugh could lift the weight off an impossible day, the friend who never walked away when someone needed him, the soul who carried the pain of an entire people but still found the room in his heart to make others smile. Today, I'm not asking the world for sympathy. I'm asking for something much simpler. See us, see our humanity, see that our grief is real. Palestinians do not bury statistics, we bury the people we love. As long as I breathe, I will speak your name. Alde Hadalin lived, he loved, he mattered, and he always will. <laughs> 20-year-old Ijdia, Alde's cousin, who has become my little brother, asked me before I left, why are you leaving? It took me some time to get the words out because I knew that the true answer wasn't as simple as, because my university semester is starting in July. It was an answer that I've been avoiding, an answer I didn't want to admit to myself and definitely not to Ijdia, which is, because I can. Since coming back to so-called Australia, I've been struggling to comprehend how these two realities could exist simultaneously. Why do I have the option of escaping to safety while people I love have only the option of fighting to survive another day? Who am I to choose comfort when I know the terrorizing feeling of every minute of every day in Musafariyata as families await the next attack? How dare I? How dare we? If they don't have the option of giving up, neither do we. If they don't have the option of not living under occupation or through a genocide, we shouldn't have the option of not doing everything in our power to fight for their freedom. If fighting for Palestine hasn't required sacrifice from you, I think you should be asking yourself, have I been doing enough? We can all do more. We must all do more. Raise your voice for those who are silenced. Use your privileges to do what others can't. Visit Palestine, sit for yourself. If you're interested in participating in solidarity presence in the West Bank, please find me during the march. I'll be holding this sign. Glory to the martyrs, justice for Ode Havelin. May his memory be a revolution. Abolish Zionism, fuck Israel, and free Palestine. Thank you.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
And you're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
On 8:55 a.m.
And we're back. It's Solidarity Breakfast on 3CR, your community radio station. And we've got Agapi on the line. G'day, Agapi. How are you?
I am good, thank you. And how are you?
Good. It's not so cold today.
Let's see what's going to happen the rest of the day.
Kalimera, Agapi. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Buongiorno, buongiorno. Come sta? Good.
Yeah, good. You've come to, on the show to tell us about an important new action for the suburbs of, I mean, the residents of the best suburbs in Melbourne, the northern suburbs, the Darabin Council. What are we doing?
Well, this is going to happen on the 25th of August at a regular council meeting, the Darabin Council. We're putting in the motion to name the Reservoir Library after Gaetano Greco. This was a man that dedicated 17 years of representing the people of Reservoir. There's a nickname for him, and I'm sorry if I'm going to say it wrong in Italian. It's Campione del Popolo, the champion of the people.
That was well said, Agapi.
The important thing to note is that Gaetano is someone that dedicated his life to Darabin, to the northern suburbs, but to people more broadly, led campaigns to save Preston Market, was part of the New International Bookshop, among other things, and the list sort of goes on. But I mean,
can I just go in here? He was instrumental in establishing the Darabin Welcome Refugees. It was his initiative to do the Darabin Intercultural Centre, the Save the Press, the Market, and the asylum seekers and the refugees.
Yeah,
and he's kind of worked for 17 years in this council.
And another thing to remember is he was also a very proud and staunch union activist when he was working in the public service for many years. Yeah.
Yes.
He also was, more than that, he was one of these people who actually, you know, it's almost like a positive virus. Like, he went around talking with all types of people and brought them into the struggle, didn't he?
Exactly, yes, yes. He was well respected as an independent voice, but also as a mentor. People sought out his opinion. People sought out to talk to him. And as you said, he talked with everyone.
Yeah, he was a courageous character.
I can recount an anecdote that was told to me by someone that grew up having him in his life as an adult presence. He was one of the only, this person recounted to me that he was one of the only people that that listened to kids' opinion. So when the adults were often talking to their own things, Gaetano would often come and sit with the children and hear what their thoughts were and see what they thought of the world, even encouraging political thought. But we say all these nice things because, Agapi, what are we fighting for really here? What do we want to do to rename the Reservoir Library? We want to force the council to acknowledge the legacy of this great person.
We need people to get behind this. We need people to be present on the 25th of August. We need the councillors and the council officers to see that people are behind this.
So we're just trying to build a campaign, and I mean, there's a link that people can go to that we'll put in the show notes. But really, we need people to email council.
To show their support.
Yes, to email councillors and show their support, yes.
And take a leaf out of Gaetano's book, which is Be Active, Stand Up. Make sure that everybody's hearing your voice.
Exactly.
Thanks for talking to us this morning.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Agapi. Have a great day.
You too. Ciao.
Ciao.
What happens when dingoes return to country? Find out at a special evening presented by Dingo Culture, Defend the Wild and the Dingo Conservancy. Experience two powerful short films, Mort, Calling Dingo Back to Country, and Wooleen, utilising dingoes as a management tool, followed by an expert panel discussion and audience Q&A. Friday, August the 14th, St Kilda Town Hall at 6:30pm. Book now at defendthewild.org or go to events.humanitix.com and search for Dingo. The Dingo Conservancy is a 3CR supporter.
Now, we were hoping to have someone to talk to about these films and this event, but having actually had a look at them, and you, Matthew, you looked at one of them.
Yeah, I watched the one set in Willeen where it was...
Utilising dingoes as a management tool, which is sort of fascinating because both of these films, they're short, but they're good kick-off points for the panel discussion that's going to happen next on the night, which is on the 14th, Friday, August the 14th at St Kilda Town Hall. What's really important about the dingo and these two films is that they're explaining to us what the focus, what dingo's role is as part of the ecological chain in Australia and the obsession that Europeans have of shooting dogs to protect their flocks has brought the dingo to its knees. The government actually pays people to bait. They chuck baits down from helicopters across the landscape to kill dingoes. The problem is that as the guy, David Pollock's going to be there, he's come all the way from Willeen and he's going to be, that's in Western Australia. So we're getting voices from a Western Australian pastoralist and we're getting voices from Indigenous people who have, as the film says, we're totem people. And they do this thing which is so remarkable to a European. They talk about our countrymen, the dingo, the countrymen. They don't separate their humanness from the general animal world. We're not special. We are part of the landscape just like the dingo. And they grieve they're fighting for the dingo and the importance of the dingo to the landscape. The pastoralist does too. He gives this film is absolutely riveting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's really, really well shot. And I'll say that watching David Pollock is a very, he's a very eloquent advocate for this approach. And I was shocked. Well, I actually, after watching the film, I actually went to the website for land owners for dingoes, and I was shocked to find out just how the extent of poisoning of dingoes, and it was only...
They pay people to do it.
They pay people to do it, yeah.
And he talks about how he has to pay a levy for not doing what they consider to be his oar to get rid of dingoes.
I think, I recall it was about $15,000 he had to pay.
Yeah. Even though the dingoes has helped to regenerate the whole land that had become barren because it was losing its integrity because of the he's got a funny way of calling it the that wasn't unlicensed grazers, but you know, like goats and things like that were actually destroying the landscape. The ancient landscape, which is, of course, Australia, the integrity of the soils and he explains that the goats will eat anything, and they eat all the trees along the gums along the river. That consequently causes the river to lose its structure, and it becomes a mud pond. And by the returning of the dingoes, they've now over time. The trees are coming back and the water is clear. Like it's a phenomenon. It's like Europeans need to go to school again and discover what country they're actually in.
Well, they're completely different ways of thinking. So we had a friend of the show, Maluma May, on Radio Phil F this weekend. Matthew and I weren't present, but she stayed at my house later and we were talking just about this thing and she spoke on the show about the intersection of climate crisis and the way that people exist on this country and just how important it is to recognize, I guess, a place in a broader ecosystem. And this thing, like she just fostered a dog with her partner, Birrigan, also a friend of the show, and they were calling him Countryman.
Yeah, so just Countryman.
Even a foster dog.
Isn't it beautiful, beautiful, beautiful?
So, yeah, the way that the hierarchy is structured doesn't remove people from... the chain somehow outside of the ecosystem. It's really one with it. And I mean, we only have to see places like Maribyrnong River to see how riverbank erosion has impacted those floodplains, and how the Flemington Racecourse being concreted up has impacted the most disadvantaged.
It's interesting you mentioned Maribyrnong River, because I've got memories from my childhood, and my dad explained to me that at one point that whole area was nearby abattoirs, and they would release, you know, the waste. And there were reports that even somehow sharks made their way in because of it. Yeah, I don't know whether it's true it is, but I've got memories of my dad actually telling me that. So,
But the level of disrespect for the natural environment, it's a killer, isn't it? Yeah. And it's going to be a literal killer. If you want to find out more about this, you should go to the St Kilda Town Hall on Friday, August the 14th, and be part of the panel and discussion. Absolutely fascinating films. It's an event that's been brought together by Defend the Wild and Dingo Culture, and they've teamed with the Dingo Conservancy.
Conservancy.
And the films are Moot Calling Dingo Back to Country, and Landholders for Dingo's film Wooleen, Utilising Dingoes as a Management Tool. There's going to be David Pollock from Wooleen Station. There's going to be Sonia Gray, a Grant from the founder and the National First Nations Dingo Coordinator for Dingo Culture, and cinematographer and ecosystem biologist Dr. Daniel Hunter. They're all going to be there, and you should be there too, because it's terribly important that we understand the country we live in and our part in saving it.
Hello, this is Malil Mamey from Boolagan, and you're listening to 3CR.
A weak solidarity brekkie team listener, when the Socialist Party's bottomless courage was running riot yet again, as it ran away from its inhumane, no proper papers, queue jumping, illegal boat people immigration policy to adopt an even more inhumane, no proper papers, queue jumping, illegal boat people immigration policy. Bravely buckling at the knees in what will be a vain attempt to avert attacks from we know who. The extremists don't need to be in government to control the agenda, but we need no further proof of the sheer humanity and compassion of those policies than that our mother country, His Most Gracious Majesty's home country version of we know who, Nigel Farage the Depth, has promised to adopt the true blue Aussie border policy. He would launch the largest train killer operation in the English Channel since World War II. What the true blue Aussie precedent proved is that the guarantee of return is the most successful deterrent, Nigel announced, and we all know those fleeing persecution and poverty must be deterred. Thank you many times over, former Big Supremo Little Kevy Rod for the Workers. Imagine if all these people, the non-white ones, weren't flooding this country, everybody would be able to afford a home of their own. Very confusing homes. Last year, as prices soared, the property industry said it wanted nothing more than that homes should be affordable, good for the economy. But this year, as prices are falling, we suggest very temporarily, and thus homes are ever so slightly more affordable, the same wise experts tell us this is an economic disaster. Strange that. But a man who does need compassion and displays it in spades. This week our hearts go out to poor Jerry Harvesting Fortunes of Harvesting Fortunes Norman, whose ubiquitous ads are a boon to so much of the mainstream media. The difference between profit and loss. Well, as ubiquitous as the gambling ads, the difference are just loss. No, huge profits and lots of losses. In fact, we were wondering what had happened after reporting 3 or 4 years ago poor Jerry had been hit, unbelievably, who would have thought, with deceptive advertising. Who would have thought? Jerry, honest Jerry, see, all those ads he ran offering no deposit interest free and all that. Well, it turned out they weren't quite so no deposit interest free. You had to pay up front for a give-no-latitude credit card involving ongoing charges. Yes, not quite no deposit interest free. Jerry and Give No Latitude just forgot to mention that bit. The case finally hit court and Give No copped a $20 million fine and poor Jerry was hit for $35 million. He copped a bigger fine because, sit down, you're not going to believe this, because His Honour said, Jerry, poor Jerry, has a complete disregard for the potential harm suffered by consumers. And in fairness, Jerry didn't help his cause when he told the Sydney Morning Herald, the whole legal system is completely effed in Troubler, was he? Probably not all that smart in the circumstances. And with a bit of luck, people won't stop shopping and harvesting fortunes. What thanks for a corporate hero who so often advises government on ways that can help him harvest even bigger fortunes. And interesting, Jerry has been known to take other people to court, the effed legal system, when it suits him. Oh, let's be honest, it couldn't happen to a nicer. Jerry's small problem didn't seem to gather as much mainstream media coverage as the wall-to-wall attacks on former state socialist supremo Dan Anscrews the workers and union heavyweight Peter Marshall the troops, criticised for meeting to stitch up a deal for firefighters. What a disgrace, a socialist party supremo meeting an evil union leader. Shame, Dan. Shame, evil union leader. Notice big supremo Anthony Albanese met with the macro profit soft supremo as the big tech giants all seem to have ex-socialist party aficionados as their PR people. Indeed, a former Anthony chief of staff is macro profit's head of government affairs. And what do we know? The big tech giants are rubbing their hands together happily over Anthony's announcements on AI itself and the news content issue, a good, good secret meeting, unlike the evil of a socialist party state supremo meeting a union official. Oh, and great news, resource giant Rio Tinto the Planet's half-yearly profit shot up to $9.5 billion thanks to soaring metal prices. That must be good for all of us. Oh, and Anthony has approached the New South Wales out-of-control socialist supremo Chris Minjie to join him in bailing out the Tomago aluminium smelter owned by, we guessed it, Rio Tinto the Planet. Apparently the $9.5 billion windfall profits just can't save the day. But that's a good meeting with the caring business class, generously allowing government, which has no role in the private sector, to play a small multi-billion dollar role in the private sector, unlike the evil of a socialist party state supremo meeting a union official. Oh, and thanks to Donald and Benjamin stuffing up the world economy, Troubler Aussie Capitalist Review headline says it all. Ample profits rakes it in on refining, trebling profits. But treble is clearly not enough, because headline 2 days earlier, refiners rake it in but want more aid. Ample profits and Viva Energy Pollution are locked in discussions with government over the terms for long-term support. Well, that's also good. That's what governments are for. Meet good, good corporate citizens and give them a little help. Not like evil meetings, deals, giving workers more pay and better conditions. That's worth a corruption reference. Chris Minjie himself met with Transfer Your Wealth Urban Private Road behemoth to stitch up a deal on Transfer Your Spaghetti Bowl of Sydney Private Roads and, surprise, surprise, one economic commentator declared, the biggest winner is the city's only private tollway operator, Transfer Your Wealth Urban. It's hard to argue Transfer Your isn't walking away with the biggest victory. Go on. It did threaten to sue the public purse for billions in the course of negotiations, but that's a good meeting of state supremo and responsible corporates, unlike, well, I think we're getting the picture. Back here, Transfer Your promised its Westgate Tunnel would get trucks off roads in Yarraville and Footscray. Very good. Small problem, though. Truck pollution in Kensington has trebled as drivers seek rat-run alternatives to the sky-high toll charges for which Transfer Your got even more concessions from the public purse. Speaking of Jerry's perhaps slightly poorly timed attack on the effed legal system and those ubiquitous gambling ads, Also, perhaps not great timing for New South Wales de facto big supremo, Peter Volandi's Millions, emperor of the rugby league and racing empires, as the Senate grills the gambling industry and its victims. Those questioning the gambling industry were publicity-seeking extremists, Pete declared. Their main aim is to run everyone's lives. Something Pete would never do. And cruel, 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 one of the publicity-seeking extremist senators reckoned Pete doesn't have the courage to front up to a Senate inquiry, even suggesting the government should force Pete to appear before the inquiry, when we all know Pete is above such trivia. And what's more, he's too busy stitching up deals with the gambling giants, good deals, good meetings, unlike evil union deals. And unlike good, good, non-evil unions like the Shopping the Workers Union, the industrial alma mater of our new state supremo. I raise that because it could be a bit difficult to shop at supermarket giant Kills Value as it announces it will transfer more than 1,000 jobs to India. That's a bloody long way to go to work every morning. And a long way, long walk and swim to the self-serve machine so we can do the work they used to pay workers to do. Something, incidentally, I refuse to do. I'm saving your job, I say, if I can find someone to serve me. And, of course, Kills Value et al. Have no idea the produce they flog involves slave labour. Something we didn't need to be told yet again this week. And given the number of times the exploitation of fruit and vegetable pickers, the very people the immigration policy would exclude, has been publicised, we can but wonder why it hasn't been stamped out and workers treated like, wait for it, human beings. Oh, of course, Anthony says slave labour doesn't exist. On the media, that decision by the Channel None network to sack that Carl bloke over his interview with that appalling Hoon Sun's fascist friend Tommy has been exposed as a big, big mistake by a most reliable source, former Channel None supremo Jamie Puker himself, who said the interview was not bad and he speaks independently. Even if Carl does use Jamie's multi-million-dollar Bondi apartment and spends time on Jamie's luxury yacht, the sacking was hypocritical, Jamie said, and on that, we'd probably have to agree, given Channel None's normal rubbish. Finally, the Getting Priorities Right department, True Blue Aussie Capless Review story, major bird flu outbreak risks. Tragedy for our feathered friends, I hear. Well, no. Risks, inflation spike. Stuff the wildlife. It's the economy, stupid. Good morning.
People are where they are. You're going to have to meet them where they are. And you're going to have to be generous. And that's why it comes back to the idea of friendship. Friendship is never with people who are just like you. What a boring world it would be if you only made friends with people identical to yourself. You know, then again, you might as well have imaginary friends. You want to learn from people. You want to laugh with them. You want to laugh at their limitations. They laugh at your limitations. You grow together, yeah? So, politics is also like that. If you're just stagnant, you know, if somebody enters politics age 15 and when they are 35, it's the same person. Terrible. They haven't grown. They haven't shaped themselves. I'm Vijay Prashad with 3CR. You better listen to it because it's really good.
Hey, will you come to my aid? If I'm in trouble, will you know? Will you hear me? Your voice split the waterways, drove a day through battle, made a circle from a speck. And if I have a hard time being in my body, if I want to run from everything she tells me, if I would have from all I've hated. Can I borrow your eyes and let love take me? Hey, will you know my name? Or will my name not matter in the circle you create? I hear in your moving water, I am my own shelter. If I fail, oh farewell. And if I have a hard time being in my body, if I want to run from everything she tells me, if I want help from all I've hated, can I borrow your eyes and let love take me? Can I borrow your eyes and let love take me?
Oh, what a lovely song. That's Mia Dyson and Stringer, and I can't see the other people, but it's a lovely little...
That was a beautiful ode.
It was.
Really lovely.
We're coming to the end of the program. This is Solidarity Breakfast this morning on 3CR, your community radio station. And we're going to finish with a conversation I had with Don Sutherland. Now, Don is in Cuba, or Cuba, as he calls it, which obviously means that that's what the Cubans call it. It's Cuba. And he'll explain what he's doing over there. But I was lucky enough to catch him, and he gives us a little bit of an understanding of what it's like for Cubans under the illegal blockade that the diabolical Trump has enforced on these courageous people. So here we go. Let's hear from Don. It's great to hear from you, Don. I know that you're in Cuba. You're in Havana. Can you get our listeners an understanding of your connection to Havana and the work that people are doing at the hospital, you and your compatriots?
Yes, well, in Australia, I'm the president of the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund, and I took that job on in about 2007 or 8. Anyway, that was founded by Taz Bull and a group of other people, including Meredith Bergman from the ALP in New South Wales and Peter Jennings from AFIDA. And what we do in solidarity with Cuba is directly for the children who are assisted in the cardiopediatric centre, which is a hospital with surgery and everything else that goes with that, for the children of Cuba who are born with, or later on, usually for genetic reasons, contract some sort of serious, or have at birth some serious heart condition like a hole in the heart or something, of things of that nature. So we respond to requests for specific assistance, and there's a long list of things that we have been able to deliver by raising the funds, finding a place in some place of the world that can provide the equipment, and then buying it and getting it across the blockade. So we're not a charity. We're an organisation providing practical solidarity in defiance of the United States' illegal blockade or sanctions or embargo that has been in existence against Cuba for 60-plus years.
They ask you to come over, because that's why you're in Cuba. That's why you're in Havana at the moment. They asked you specifically to come because they needed specific things, didn't they?
We needed to review the status of our contributions anyway because of the impact of Trump's escalation of the illegal blockade. But they, as it turned out, they wanted to present me with a very important Cuban award, which is decided upon by the senior organ of government, the Council of Ministers. And so, yeah, that happened about 3 or 4 days ago.
Oh, congratulations. Dr. Salmon, who was going to be on this call, couldn't because he had to go to an emergency, didn't he?
Yes, in the conditions of the United States criminal escalation of the blockade that robs Cuba of trading rights to access what we call petrol and other things, many other materials and equipment that they have purchased in the normal international trade way. Because of that escalation, daily life in Cuba is often made up on the run, and today was a typical one. We were planning a day in which he would do his normal duties. I think he had one surgery or two in the normal planning, and then clinical visits to all the patients and their parents if necessary, and then time with me to talk about various aspects of the relationship and the work we're doing. And also assisting with interviews with two people. It was intended that I do an interview with a doctor who has just returned as a member of the Cuban Medical Brigade to Mexico, and also a graduation of open heart surgery, successful from 2011. I was going to be talking with him about his experience as a child and how he's going now, 16 years later. Then suddenly there was a collapse of the water pressure. And, of course, he has to be, you know, sort of in the thick of helping and working with the engineers to solve the problem. And simultaneously, a newborn child was found to have serious cardiac problems and needed emergency surgery. We're talking about a newborn child. So if you think in terms of about, at the most, about 30 centimetres long, you can. This is the daily bread and butter for the wonderful Dr. Salmon and his wonderful teams, plural. And so that has disturbed regular planning. And so I sit patiently waiting to hear the news, and having just bumped into another Australian in the garden of the hotel where I'm staying. But that's the story of today. And that is a classic cardiopediatric centre day. Essentially, in the cardiopediatric centre, there are three main stages of the process. Of course, there is the discovery and the preparation of children for surgery. Then there's the surgery period and the immediate post-surgery care, which is done in a perfectly sterilised but very old facility right next to the operating theatres. Then after that, there is the short to longer term preparation of the patients for the rest of their lives. Several of whom I have met and enjoyed the company of over my last, what is nearly probably a fortnight now.
So, Don, there's a couple of things there. I mean, doing a little research, you said that Cuba has already bought all these kind of things, medical supplies, that are sitting in ports outside and won't be brought in because of the American illegal embargo. I mean, but they're actually already have bought these items, and the world is actually just sitting there with their hands tied because of the Americans.
Yes, that's correct. I've seen various numbers, but there's around, let's say around 10,000, there may be more or there may be a little bit less, 10,000 containers of purchased equipment and supplies, not just medical, but other equipment and so on as well, sitting in containers in various Caribbean ports. And the illegal blockade that Trump has intensified is preventing them from being moved from those ports legitimately into the hands of the Cubans. I think probably there is some aid contributions in there as well. I do not know that for sure, but I suspect that's the case. There is other support coming in from various organisations, but it is mainly in small shipments. And, of course, everyone who's visiting Cuba, who knows anything about Cuba, do bring things in their suitcases and so on that are useful and make a difference in daily lives.
Can you tell us what are the most extreme examples of what's going on that causes troubles for people in their daily life because of this embargo? From your observation.
Well, let's talk about daily life, because it's, rather than just the sort of operation of the hospital and the rescue of babies from you know, serious heart problems. Yeah, well, I've only been here a fortnight, but I've been heavily exposed to, I think, around four or five different sites where I can see and have conversations with people about daily life. Directly, the most serious problem is the blockade against fuel, because Cuba depends upon that for powering its electricity grid. Now, the sort of opposite to that is the steadily growing installation of solar power and so on. But it is nowhere near yet. It's growing and you can see it. You know, you can see that part of modernity happening in Cuba because they want it. But it's nowhere near being able to solve enough problems for enough people when it comes to energy. Now, that means every household at some part of the day and sometimes for a big part of the day are without power.
Mm.
And that means that immediately creates problems. The first big problem is water pressure. And then the next thing that flows from that is sleep. It is very difficult for Cubans, particularly those living at a median to middle standard of living, to get good quality sleep if the electricity is down, because that means it's the summer. It's a hot summer.
Mm. Yep. No air conditioning.
And so they're restless and so on. So when they wake up to go to work the next day, they haven't had enough sleep. That's pretty well day in and day out. The second thing that flows from that, although I'm pretty sure there is good supply of fresh food, the problem is how to keep...
So refrigeration, you're talking about refrigeration.
Yeah, talking about refrigeration. And so that really does put enormous strain. Now, in the two working class households where I spent 2 or 3 hours in the middle of just daily life, where I was treated beautifully as a guest, but also I was able to observe neighbours coming and going and kids playing in the street and all of those sorts of things. And these are in two different parts of a middle-sized town. These problems are real. How do they deal with that? Now, this is the other side of the whole story that is not discussed enough. First, the electricity grid workers and the water supply system workers are astonishing. Decades of blockade means they do not have the most up-to-date power supply, water supply systems. In any case, that's been denied to them. Now, with the intensification and the lack of fuel, with constant shutdown, then restarting old equipment is more difficult. And yet that's what they do every day. And they are the most dedicated and skilled and creative workforce you could ever possibly imagine. Just wonderful. I just try to imagine what they would bring to a system that is based on modern technology, up-to-date technology in power and water supply.
Mm.
I think, you know, this is Cuba's untapped potential. And this story about the electricity workers day in and day out and the water supply workers day in and day out solving the problems created by the criminal blockade is not being told enough. I think it's an ongoing heroic effort by those workers. So the second part of that is in households, whole households, how they are interacting with the neighbours they know and the ones they don't to solve their experience of the problems.
Yep.
That takes many forms. So I'll give one example. What I have seen, not just in this town, was an increase in bartering. So a family or a household may have a particular useful material need, more than they need. So they will bring that to a friend's place or a neighbour's place where they'll exchange that for something that the others have.
Yep.
Or not even exchange. Just share.
Yeah, yeah. Just, you know, it's like it's returning to the 18th century, effectively, or pre the 20th century.
Well, no, because when you see film footage of life for Cubans under the dictatorship, the mafia, and the United States corporations that owned the food production system in Cuba before the revolution. It is the most abhorrent images of how people were treated before the revolution.
Yep.
And that is what Trump wants to return to.
Yeah, I know.
That is what Trump and his cronies, with the mafia lurking in the background, want to get back to. They want to get back to Cuba as a place where they can go for entertainment and which they can plunder for its food supply. And now its burgeoning and wonderful pharmaceutical industry. That's what they want. They want that opportunity to plunder again. So the conditions of life before that, when you see the video footage of life in the suburbs and the countrysides of Cuba before the revolution, no, the way in which adaptation is occurring right now in the suburbs is primarily loaded with solidarity for each other.
So the general public in Cuba, what's the general sense of that you're finding? I mean, because it's a horribly perilous position they're in.
Yes. The first thing to remember in thinking about that question is that Cuba is a developing country in the global south that is developing on the basis of a humanism with socialist characteristics. Most other developing countries that need solidarity and aid have not achieved that. So here there is a struggle not just for material life, but to defend and advance in how the individuals in society relate to each other.
Yep.
So we come to the presence of this special humanism in civil society. That is under pressure. There is no question of it. Probably, this is a rough guess, and I emphasize that, probably since 2018, the proportion of the population who are very unhappy with the government is up to around 15 to 20%. But only a minority of them want the United States as the solution. The majority, even of those who are unhappy with the government, which I guess is around somewhere between 15 to 20%, which is more than 2018 and two, for sure. The majority don't want a military solution or a US puppet. The rest are fighting in struggle in an economic war. They are waging counter warfare with humanist conceived solidarity with each other. That's the majority sentiment.
Hmm. Do they think that they're going to be attacked physically?
I think the view is that that would not come as a surprise to them, but they continue to make life happen every day without being obsessed by it.
Okay.
Well, I'm pretty certain of this because I've discussed it with a few people. They don't discuss it very much with each other. They get on with life, but they also know that it's on the cards. And what is clear is they also know they'll get the worst of it. The people of Cuba will get the worst of it because there will be resistance also. Now, what form that takes is obviously there has to be some sort of planning going on about that, of course.
How does Guantanamo Bay fit into all this?
Guantanamo Bay, it's a portion of Cuba on the southern side of the island towards the east, and it is
an American concentration camp.
It's an American base that has been used in the 21st century as a concentration camp, of course. And there are still political prisoners from Iraq in Guantanamo Bay in appalling conditions. But it also has all of the other facilities that an American base has. And it's illegal, and it's been there since Cuba's War of Independence at the beginning of the 20th century. How that fits into anything that might happen of a military character, you can bet there's lots of intelligence technology used from there, as there would be from the American embassy in Havana. You can bet that there are, in fact, probably thousands of State Department, CIA-trained spies in Cuba, operating on a daily basis. How that will unfold is, well, I think the general assessment is that it won't go well for the Kulbans, but they will fight with, you know, incredible power and dignity for their sovereignty and their homeland.
Because we should come to an end, can you tell us how we can be of any assistance in what you're doing for and for the hospital that you're connected to? Is there anything that we could be of assistance?
Tragically, there are a long list of places around the world that need solidarity. I'm nervous about saying this, but I think Cuba is at the centre of a massive turning point in what direction does the world go generally? Does the march for barbarism expand dramatically, or are the forces of humanism and socialism able to stop it, to stabilise and to march onwards themselves? That's the big inflection. That's the big turning point. And Cuba is in the centre of that. So first thing, learn, study. Second thing is get familiar with Cuba and its struggles against the blockade and the empire, the most powerful empire in the history of humanity. Then learn about organisations like ours, the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund, and also, importantly, the Australia-Cuba Friendship Societies. These are places where you can make a contribution that is both in words and in practical form with material support. There are wonderful people in every capital city who are doing solidarity work with Cuba, and it takes many forms and there's lots of things you can do. Our organisation is supported by a feeder. We are part of a feeder, the Union Aid Abroad. If you wish to make a money donation, that would be extremely welcome because we have a new project or two in the making. I leave Cuba on Monday, Thursday here, so it's 4 days away.
Oh, too soon. Okay. All right. Wish them well. Wish them well from us.
Yeah, and today I came across a rather delightful knick-knack, and it's a little sort of wristband. Its symbol on it, it shows two rivers intertwined. And I bought it because it symbolises what the future between Australia and Cuba should be. Australia one river, Cuba another, but we flow into each other, and that's the future. It doesn't exist right now, but it's not far away from being made.
Guinea, this is Birrigan from Bulagan, coming live from the occupied territories of Gumbengi country, Nambucca Heads, New South Wales. You're listening to 3CR Radical Radio.
And that's the end of the program, you guys. That was a conversation I had with one of our regulars, Don Sutherland, who's in Cuba. And as he said, he's part of a group who support the Cuban Children's Hospital Fund. We will put the information up on the page for anybody who wishes to support their struggle. It's really sobering, isn't it, to think how much fortitude the Cubans are showing.
Yeah, thanks for Don Sutherland for doing that interview. That was actually incredible to listen to. And the Cuba Friendship Society is sending another round of brigades this year, leaving December.
Yeah, there you go. Anyway, there are some events that we might like to tell people about.
Lost in Science Trivia Night at the Birmingham Hotel on Smith Street, 7 p.m. 17th of August. Get down if you're any good at trivia.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, actually, there's something from the 12th of August, which is artificial intelligence and work in a remade world. It's a NIBS event. It's going to be on the 12th of August, the 6 p.m. at the Ballot Mill Room Trades Hall. $10 tickets. You can get the get a ticket from Humanitex. And the speakers are going to be Lalila Anderson from MEAA, Christopher O'Neill from Monash, and Timothy Eric Strom from Arena. Quite an interesting affair. There's the Defend Unions, Defend the CFMEU event, workshop and panel. What can the 1986 nurses' strike teach us today? It's on the 22nd of August at 2 p.m. at Ballum Ballum, 5 Phoenix Street in Brunswick.
Yeah, everyone better have their diaries out because we're gonna fill them up. So next week, the 14th of August, you can come to the Phil F Film Club. We're screening Pasqualino Sette Bellezze, a kind of very satirical take on what life under fascist rule looks like in Italy. It is quite funny. It is it's quite a polarizing film. So you'll either love it absolutely to bits or you hate it. It's an incredible...
What was that time and date?
Next Friday, the 14th of August at 6:30 p.m. at Democritus, 583 High Street, Northcote.
So that's if you're not going to the Dingo Films?
Yep. And there's also, again, the theme of AI and its impact on us. There's a community rally being held tomorrow at 2 p.m. at Hanson Reserve at Roberts Street, West Footscray. There will be an opportunity here from experts discussing data centre policy, residents in West Footscray, and also local political candidates who are running for the seat of Footscray to hear their views. That's being run by the Borderlands Collective, as well as Citizens for Tottenham, and that's tomorrow.
Yeah, fantastic. And just a reminder that the 22nd Annual Green Left Comedy Debate is going to be on August the 22nd, 6:30 p.m. at the Brunswick Town Hall. So we're going to go out with, that's a wrap, and we're going to go out with Rise Up from the Leroy Johnson and Waterbag Band. And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents.
Walk on by, they don't look at me, 'cause I'm forgotten people in my country. I'm on the streets, I'm on the land, invisible to the average man. But rise up, don't sit back, take the future, get your pride back. Rise up, you will see, it's a sunburned land, it's not a white country. When I think back to what we saw, I don't understand what it all was for. Rounded up, always push back. You can't be here, boy, don't you know you're black? But rise up, don't sit back, take the future, get your pride back. Rise up, you will see, the time is now for you and me. Rise up, don't sit back, take the future, get your pride back. Rise up, you will see, it's a sunburned land, it's not a white country, it's not a white country. Look around, I feel a ghost of our old people. What means the most? This land of ours, our very lives, belongs to us, not them, and it's worth the fight.